Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Listen to this Acast show ad-free on Amazon Music with your Prime membership, or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, malevolent fans. This isn't the voice you usually hear on this feed, and that's because we're doing something special today. We're going to be diving into season 4 in all its guts and glory, answering questions and talking about what's next for the show. I'm Ren Brook, writer and malevolent fan, and I'm here with Harlan Guthrie, soul creator of, and every single voice, yes, even that one, of Malevolent. The reason we're all here, the reason we're crying over things like Gardettos and music boxes and cans of peaches. Harlan, hello. How are you?
Hello. I'm fantastic. How are you?
I'm pretty good.
Thank you so much for doing this and having me. I'm excited to chat Malevolent.
Yes, yes. Lots to chat about.
I hope. I'm hoping that I have enough to add to it, that my voice wasn't completely in just the show and nothing else. But I don't know. Maybe I'll have some thoughts that exist beyond what the clever fans have already created.
I think we could probably talk for an hour about Intermezzo alone.
Ooh, yes, please.
But before we get into all of that, I have to say here, this is going to be spoilers for all of season 4 and Intermezzo. So if you haven't listened to those, go listen to those first and then come back to this. And in fact, my first question dives right into Intermezzo. Get into the good stuff first.
Nice.
So those avoiding spoilers will want to turn back now. So in essentially the first moments of Malevolent in season 1, part 1, chapter 1, John lays out the idea of a multiverse and the dark world. And now in the intermezzo before season 5, 200 chapters later, we get another summary of the multiverse from Kane, and we've learned how integral these other timelines are to Kane's plans. It's an idea you set up at the very beginning, and now after four seasons, how does it feel to finally see this seed come to fruition?
Oh, man. It feels good. It's really... you know, when I had the idea, season one, for the, you know, the multiverse, the dark world, all the kind of... It was before all the hot Marvel movie multiverse stuff. I mean, obviously that existed in comic books well before. It is by no means a new idea whatsoever. It was also something I had used in my role-playing campaigns. I always loved the idea of, you know, connectivity, interconnectivity through characters that you play. You know, you sit down in a D&D game with me. Well, what if your character in this, you know, is a long distant cousin from this other campaign that we played? I just always found that really comforting and really fun. So it was something that kind of carried over from my RPGs, but Intermezzo was kind of, yeah, it was the final point that I got to clarify, and boy, did it take a long time to like crystallize it in the script of what the bigger picture here is in Malevolent. You know, to agree, yes, it's all led to this. I know a lot of people, you know, especially in season two, when I think the show started to really blossom and people were asking, you know, well, how is this going to be satisfying if he's just writing it chapter to chapter? And I would always say, well, no, there is an underlying theme, you know, there is an underlying kind of feeling, and there is an underlying story. And I think season four and Intermezzo are really a big weight off my shoulders, hoping that the fans are like, oh, good. Okay. So not so much just the answers, but the trust, being like, okay, cool. So there was a reason he did this. There was a reason, because with the nature of my writing week by week, yeah, there are certain things I kind of have to play jazz with. There's certain things I do have to kind of make up on the fly, but I don't want that to be the cost of the larger picture that Malevolent's going. So it feels really good. It feels like a weight off my shoulders and exciting, frankly. I want to see all the theories really spinning now, you know?
It's incredibly exciting. And yes, the theories are already spinning, and they're only going to spin faster as Intermezzo hits the patrons and then the public. Intermezzo has a lot of your Call of Cthulhu campaign lore.
Yeah.
I think you did a really good job giving the audience what they need to know without going back and watching the games themselves. But two questions. How did you balance wanting to integrate this lore into Malevolent canon while knowing most people hadn't seen the games? And then two, as more lore from these games becomes Malevolent canon, would you recommend listeners seek out those games?
Well, I can answer the second one quicker. No, I don't. There's a lot with the old Call of Cthulhu games that A, I want to not really worry too much about, but B, also it's just a huge, you know, it's a huge time sink for people. And truth be told, the stuff that I'm taking from them is summed up more or less in Intermezzo, so you don't need to worry too much. I think the benefit or the beauty of it is going back kind of is like watching the behind the scenes footage from Lord of the Rings. You know, it makes things a little better. You're like, oh, you know, Aragorn broke his toe there. That's so cool. That's where the connection came. To me, it enhances Malevolent, but it doesn't answer it. So I wouldn't say don't bother if you don't want that. But, you know, if you're done listening to Malevolent and you need more, they're the perfect kind of outlet. And how was it balanced? What was the first question?
How did you balance wanting to integrate this lore knowing most people haven't seen it?
Yeah, it was tough because it's a real, you know, verbal payload being dropped by Kane, who typically isn't somebody who's serious in the way they try to, you know, give exposition and stuff like that. So it's funny because I tried to make it really playful, and then there's a point where I, writing it, was like, I think I'm losing the audience. And Kane is kind of like, get it? No? Okay, look, here. And then he just like really breaks it down Cole's notes. And that was like purposeful. I was like, I should double beat some of this stuff to make sure the important bits land, because I recognize how difficult it is sometimes to just hear somebody, even someone as entertaining as Kane, to just like lore dump on you. But, you know, for the most part, I think I've done a pretty good job of including enough of those games that I want to carry over in small drips and drabs to make what Kane says a connection rather than a whole new piece of the puzzle. You know what I mean? He talks about Henry McFarland, who his daughter is mentioned in episode one. He talks about Frank Underhill, who's mentioned in season two, and kind of becomes a character that the King in Yellow takes on to try to manipulate Arthur. So it kind of feels more like answers than it does an outright new piece of the story, which is what I was trying for. So part, you know, setup means that the payoff is less right turn, because I think that's a big thing I try to make it that when you go back, you go, oh yeah, that was, and you know, a good example being in the final episode, part 40, when you're listening to it, Noel and Arthur have a quick conversation before going into the room with the machine, where Arthur says, well, you know, and it's not just the two of us. And Noel says, that's right. And they're talking about the butcher. But I kind of wrote that trying to be clever, because I really didn't want to tip my hat. I really wanted the butcher reveal to be a hard twist. Well, I think I successfully got most people.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
I'm excited to expand on my motivation for that. But anyway, I wanted it to be vague enough that people would automatically assume, oh, yeah, well, obviously they're talking about John. But also going back being like, oh, they're talking about the fucking butcher. So, you know, when I set up things like that, I feel like that twist is a little bit more earned. And again, I think that's a big part of that balancing act in the end, where it's kind of like, these are answers more than just new lore.
Everything in part 40 and Intermezzo felt so earned. And I agree, it was a sigh, not of relief, but of, yes, we're here. And being so excited to see what's next also.
We're getting the big storyline now. Like, we're getting, because when you think about it, you know, season one was about getting Arthur and John their own bodies back. Season two was about more or less escaping the Dreamlands, but also with that as a sort of subset, like getting their bodies back. Season three was really just about like survival. Like, it was about, we got to get the fuck out of here. And then their motivations changed. And then season four was all about getting to the Order of the Fallen Star. We don't really know, or we didn't really know, what the author had in mind for like the series. Like, why does he say it ends after season six? What is the main plot here? And that was purposeful, because I didn't want to introduce the main plot point in season one or two just to have it drawn out forever. You know, I want it to be more of like a, here's what I want, here's what you can do about it, and now go do it type vibe. So, you know, it feels really good for me as well.
You mentioned the amazing twist with the butcher, and when you were writing Prelude at the beginning of this season, did you know how big of a role the butcher was going to play in the season? Or did you think it was going to be more of a one-off and he grew as the season expanded?
I definitely intended him to be a major antagonist, because at the end of season three, you know, I sort of intended Larson to be this shorter villain solved in season three was my mind. But you, again, you know, with the Patreon choices and the way my mind kind of has to reset every week to kind of see where the story goes, I end up really enjoying him and being like, you know what, this feels like kind of a bigger figure, ironically, in such a small kind of like weenie body. So, you know, like there was some serious consideration even at the end of season three that when Arthur came up to the mansion, that he was going to kill Larson. And then I kind of tweaked it and thought on it and thought, no, you know what, this makes more sense and it's more satisfying if Larson's completely gone, you know? So retooling of villains and stuff like that, you know, made me consider, okay, well, you know, if I like Larson now, I need a more minor villain. So I really wanted to do that introduction of like the minor villain type trope. And but I fully intended that there would be a cat and mouse game. It's funny because like starting season four, I knew the vibes of what I wanted, and I kind of wanted this like New York detective brutality. Like, I wanted like slamming of trunks and shotguns and like splatters of blood, and I wanted panting running down the street, and I wanted like chasing, and I don't know, I the vibe was like more 70s New York exploitation cop film than straight up malevolent. And I think there are moments in there that I succeeded at that. Ultimately, I don't think it would have worked if I tried to do the whole season like that. But like that whole butcher arc where it's his perspective is really, I could point to as what I was really aiming for season four. Like, kind of brutal, you know, the way the butcher just blows away that guy who's like hiding in a closet is like so perfect in my mind for the tone of the season, where he's just like, okay, chuck, chuck, bam, and you're like, oh my god, this is fucking horrible.
It's brutal.
And I always knew that I wanted the Butcher to be that. And I think what was interesting is as I wrote the Butcher, who I was a character I was familiar with, and Arthur, the similarities between the two, you know, the dichotomy, the reflections, you know, the brutality, the nature of, you know, killing and all that kind of stuff. I enjoyed their conversations. And what I did see, and I think a lot of the people saw, those who, you know, shipped them or made them friends or whatever, saw also this kind of like duality in their personalities. And as that came, that's when the realization dawned on me of, oh, you know what? I think there is a route here where the Butcher has turned and come to respect his prey, his quarry, you know, who's now kind of got the drop on him, more or less. There's like an honor amongst thieves type vibe from the train episode. I never intended that the Butcher would befriend Arthur at the end or be on his side. However, I knew the character well enough that he had honor in him. You know, that's why he tips his hat. The first thing you see at the end is when Arthur bests him, he literally removes his hat and like is like, hey, you got me. And looking back now, you know, that character, understanding that character more or less, is what makes the ending so obvious, because it's like, well, here's a guy who respects the game and gets it, you know. And when he loses the game, he's not petulant about it, because he has some really good moments where like Arthur is like, you know, digging his heels in, and he gets the better of Arthur here and there, you know, but for the most part, he respects it. And I thought that was a really cool thing. And when it came to the finale, or part 40, I should say, I sat down and I was like, well, look, Larson got the better of Arthur when they met. And Larson, to an extent, got the better of Arthur in New York, because, you know, he sicked the Butcher on him. But Arthur's not an idiot. And he also has Noel now. And I was like, if you had 8 hours to kill, what's your play? And in my mind, I, you know, I pictured at the end of part 39, Arthur talking to Marie for a few hours. And, you know, as his mind is drifting and she's wobbling on about whatever, you know, he gets this idea and he's like, oh, excuse me. He goes, calls Noel, and he's like, I have an idea. And they meet up and he pitches his idea, and Noel's like, that's crazy. And then the two of them go to the prison, or go to the police station, and they have this like conversation, and you know, the Butcher is like, all right, okay, fine, I can get behind this. And to me, that all made sense. And I was like, well, that's perfect. So that is how I let the audience know that Arthur is deserving of his title of like a detective, you know.
The Butcher definitely respects Arthur. Does Arthur respect the Butcher?
I think yes. I think there's a subset of Arthur, that brutal Arthur, that one who shoved his thumbs through Uncle's eyes, that recognizes the beast within all of us. And a lot, you know, a lot of malevolence is about choices. It's about who you are choosing to be in that moment. And I think I'm going to get a lot of flack from Intermezzo for people being upset about John's choice in Intermezzo. And I think that if you don't see how obviously he would make that choice, then you're not really understanding what John is, and what Arthur is, for that matter. Because if I flip the characters, I think Arthur would do the same thing. Because it's not, you know, to me, the choice John makes at the end there is a human failure, you know? It's a human issue of being like, well, you know, if I could erase this person's memory and I just fucked up, I would totally do it. The truth of the matter is, you know, this person can do it. Ultimately, he doesn't. But, you know, the tantalizing notion of just getting a little reset is like, oh, well, then I, you know, I could do this and da da da. So, you know, I think as much as Arthur is always trying to choose the better path, and same with John, they fuck up. I think the big difference is Arthur, even though he pushes it down, he's aware of it so much more than John is. Like, especially after season 3, I think the season 4 Arthur subconsciously, you know, knows like, okay, yeah, there is an ability in me to be pretty violent. And it's fun to tap into that sometimes, I suppose. We see it in chapter 40 or part 40.
We see it too in the bathroom scene where he, yeah. Which perfectly, I don't know if this was deliberate on your part, parallels the prologue of Witch's Mark, where we get introduced to Collins for the first time.
For the Call of Cthulhu games or for this?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Well, so the Call of Cthulhu games, yes, he kills a guy in the bathroom.
Yeah.
100%. And I definitely meant it to be a parallel to Butcher. And it's funny you mentioned that because, yes, that's one of those things. It's like, well, if you've heard the games, you get the direct parallel. I meant it to kind of be a companion piece to the person that the butcher kills in the barbershop in prologue as a less overt parallel because the two of them have brutality over them, you know? He's not questioning him in the prologue, obviously. He just straight and kills the guy. But the idea of, like, walking into the room really calmly, the guy talking to him, you know? I wanted to make a indirect parallel so that those searching would be like, oh, shit, you know, part 39 and prelude have similarities between Arthur and Butcher.
Since you mentioned John's choice in Intermezzo, you sniped my question, which is, why is John choosing avoidance here? But I completely agree with you. It reminded me of when I would lie about my bad report card getting lost in the mail. Like, yep. It's exactly 100%. That.
Well, and I got a lot of flack from, I think it was part 37 or maybe part 38, where Arthur calls John a kid, a child. There's a certain subset of people who were believing that I was trying to imply that those who ship them, that there's some sort of, like, you know, belittling going on. That wasn't my intention. Arthur calls John a child because emotionally he is, not physically, but the fact that Arthur is realizing that John is only new to these concepts. And, you know, the idea that, I mean, and maybe this is just from my perspective as being a parent of a six-year-old and a four-month-old, you know, like, my son can walk up to me, put a hand on my back and say, you know, Daddy, I love you. I'm so sorry you had a terrible day. You can do better. You can do everything you ever want. And I'll say, thank you, Henry. And then he'll fart and be like, I can't believe that we don't have pizza for dinner, and storm out of the room. Like children are like that because they're emotionally immature. They don't understand. And that's why in season three, John can have these emotional depths of, like, I won't let you fail. And blah, blah, blah. And then the next moment be like, okay, but Oscar needs to go, because he doesn't have 30, 40, 50 years of, like, understanding that breakneck switching that fast is not good or helpful. He doesn't get the bigger picture yet. He doesn't have wisdom. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of people may have misinterpreted Arthur calling him a child, which is why in the direct next part he addresses it. He's kind of like, no, you're a child because you're immature. And I think that's exactly exemplified in Intermezzo when you tell a child, I mean, are you telling me, you know, like a 6-year-old kid who was exactly caught for, you know, having their report card lost in the mail, and then you said, listen, we can pretend this never happened, and I will erase mom and dad's memory if you'd like. That kid would go, yes, I'll take that, please. Yes, please, that. Like, absolutely. It's to me, it's so obvious, you know?
Yeah. It's anywhere on the emotional spectrum of 6 to, like, 16, you know? He has so much teen in him as well, of the, like you said,
totally
not having those emotional tools, not having a toolbox at all, which exactly does come from experience. But then also married with, he has memories of being an all-powerful being.
Oh my God, yeah.
And getting everything he wanted all of the time.
Yep. It's like a spoiled kid. And then up until 8, and then bringing them into a house where they got nothing. It's like, listen, beans off the floor. Like, that's as much as you get. And you know, and they're happy for it. They're like, okay, like, I'm because, you know, John's not a bad person or a bad character. He's just a troubled character. And I think it's pretty clear throughout the series of the show that that's the case. I think a lot of people were frustrated thinking that season 3's moment where John has that with Arthur was like the end of his turmoil. And I, you know, I get it, but that's a bit, but no, because season 3 ended with him deceiving Arthur as well. So I think I always intended to be like, yeah, but is he really done now? Is he fully cooked now because he helped his friend, you know?
Absolutely. And it seems like this season, John has really been wrestling with what is his next move beyond the deal what is his identity? In part 40, you say he's a broken mirror for the King in Yellow, and he doesn't fit with the King anymore. But it also seems like he's struggling to fit inside Arthur more and more. He uses the term prisoner and voiceless. So where is he at the end of season 4 now?
Yeah, I mean, I think John is being introduced to that part of humanity, you know, or I suppose childhood, where, you know, you've outgrown, I guess, adolescence, you know what I mean? Where he's no longer a child, where everything is like done for him. And he's always been struggling, you know, with Arthur to an extent, but he's kind of ebbed and flowed to the point where, you know, maybe there's been moments where he's laid back and be like, you know what, I'm actually going to enjoy this ride. I'm just going to help. But as he becomes more and more mature in a way, he's also recognizing that there's a line in episode 40 where the King in Yellow, where Arthur says to the King in Yellow that you'd be trapped in Larson. And John sort of says trapped, like kind of realizing, or not realizing, but like reminding himself that he is a prisoner. And I think one of the big changes in his character in 40 is that we learn that John has a new ability, which is that he can now project himself outside of Arthur, which A, means, okay, well, what other abilities does John have? Does he have the capacity to do? And B, how does John feel about all that kind of stuff? And obviously, season 5 is going to have to first and foremost deal with the betrayal of what the hell John just did to him. But I think, and I'm excited for season 5. Season 4, I wanted to focus on Arthur. You know, we get nightmare flashbacks of Pharaoh's birth. We get to visit his father. We get Arthur to interact with all these characters. Season 5, I intend to be more like, not necessarily John focused, but to dive into his mentality, you know, without spoiling too much. I want a little bit of the other side of the coin now to kind of understand where he's at. So I think we're going to see a really interesting realization from John. And without spoiling too much, there's going to be some opportunities early in season 5 where John is going to get to kind of for the first time lay out who he is for the audience. You know what I mean? I have a few ideas for some really cool episodes because we get to see a lot of Arthur's side of things and we don't get to see much of John's side of things. So, but suffice to say that I think we're only just about to see where John sees himself and how he feels about all of what's been going on. For better or for worse, because obviously there's moments where I think, like anybody, John feels powerful when he gets to pull Arthur out of the brink, you know? Power is a big theme, you know, being powerful doesn't make you better, which is said, echoed by John, which is something Arthur says, not even to him, but to Yellow in season 3 in the finale. And here we are also kind of, we have to acknowledge that Arthur and John are struggling for power. In an emotional sense, you know, like the reason John was so comfortable, and this gets addressed in, I think, part 38 as well. The reason John was so comfortable with Arthur in the end of season 3 is because he had the emotional power. He got to pick his friend up. You know how validating that feels? If you're in a relationship and your partner is crumbling and you're like, hey, listen, like you can do this. Of course, you're being loving and caring, but you also have this thrill of like, I just helped somebody. That feels so good. You know what I mean? And I think a lot of people think that feelings like that exist in a bubble. You know, it's like when you have people online handing bottles of water to homeless people. It's like they're filming it for a reason. They're not just doing it because they're good. They're doing it because they also want people to make them feel good about doing a good thing. And that's why the many shades of humanity exist in Malevolent. I've never, ever tried to make these characters two-dimensional. And I think it's much to the chagrin of many listeners because they think, well, no, John is good now, or John is bad now, or, you know, Arthur's good now, Arthur's bad now. And I feel like since day one, it's been like, no, that's not. If anything, that echoes the multiverse theory more than anything, is that there are so many versions of us, so many ways that we can be perceived, that Arthur in one episode can say, I'll never hurt another living thing, and in another episode, gouge the eyes out of a weird ram person, you know? So long story short, we'll see a lot of John's true mentality in season 5 is my plan. You know?
Interesting. Very interesting. That makes me think about the two kind of bottle episodes we got this season and you playing around with format.
Yes,
and
100%. I have a format idea for season 5 that I think will be really fun.
Oh, that's very exciting. Going back to season 4, John. So before part 39, the only significant time John communicated to a living thing, not counting the king or Cain or any other entities, was Lily in part 20, where he has Arthur impart final words to her. And then he doesn't have a voice again until part 39. Mm-hmm. And John's first words that are ever spoken aloud to another human being are, "I feel at times like a prisoner, voiceless, unheard."
Mm-hmm.
And then he finds instant empathy in Noel. So how did meeting Noel change John this season? And in the trajectory of John's story so far, how important is this moment of being heard?
Oh, very important. I think the audience picked up on that right away. I think that moment was more or less specifically engineered to be a counter to how he felt about Oscar. You know, like, John was introduced to Lily and humanity, you know, days ago, more or less, in that. But what we now know with Intermezzo is that he also spent a long time in the dark world between Lily and coming back to Arthur. And season 3, when he comes back, you know, we don't know how long he's been gone, and he's just kind of thankful. He's like, "Oh my God, yes, thank you." You know, it's kind of the opposite of season 1, where he's just manipulative. Now he's just like thankful, which is why it was so easy for him in season 3 to kind of be like, "Okay, everything's great. I got to do this thing with Cain. I got to fulfill my obligation, but everything's great. It's fantastic." You know, now he is sort of falling back into his old ways as New York is kind of playing out, and he's realizing, "Oh God, no, like this isn't the savior I thought. I'm out of the dark world. I'm feeling better, but I'm still lost in this." And I think he, especially with Oscar, becomes callous because he's, you know, lost so much of his voice in the season to a degree that he's removed himself from the desire for humanity after such a long time in the dark world. To a degree, obviously, he's not ready to abandon it, but he just isn't focusing on it in any way, shape, or form. And he's like, "Well, you know, get rid of Oscar, it's easier." And when that realization comes out, it's like, "Whoa, fuck, like, what are you talking about?" He sort of has this moment of like, "This is gonna be fine. Like, this is good." They're in the car driving, and John's like, "See, like, this is what we wanted." And he's sort of internalizing and being like, "Right, this is good. This is better now. It's just us again. It's gonna be cool." So I think that like hits him like a ton of bricks when he realizes, you know, if he had a chance to speak with Oscar, Oscar would have been equally as empathetic, possibly, if he believed Arthur, and that he sees the figures in Arthur's life not as just these obstacles or just these things that Arthur is interacting with, but as empathetic creatures, the way he saw Lily, you know what I mean? And that's why Lily was something he empathized with, because it wasn't anything that took away from his experience. Lily was just a part of their journey together, you know, and it was easy for him to connect to that. But these other things are just obstacles. They're in the way, you know, like, I want to be the one that's talking to Arthur because that's what we fucking do, man. Like, and now he's like, "Oh shit, Noel's a real dude as well." And that was so important for what happens in episode 40, because John jumping out of Arthur's skin isn't about Arthur. It's about Noel. It's about him empathizing with a creature to the point where he can manifest power. So that's a huge development in terms of, I guess, his character. And I suppose that's really what your question was, which I think is really fair. I guess to me, because I haven't got to dive into the meat and potatoes of him explaining that yet, it feels like I haven't got to sink my teeth into it yet. You know what I mean? And that's kind of one of the issues with writing piecemeal, is that until I get to sit down and write the episode where John talks about that feeling, I know what I've intended with it, but I haven't got to actually express it yet. But you're entirely right. That is really a big turning point in his character, because that's when he's sort of learning that these figures in Arthur's life aren't just figures, they're not just obstacles. Now, of course, that gets kind of like pushed over because the deal with Cain is so much more important for him, because he does anything to not go back to the dark world, you know, which is sort of the implication of what that deal means. You know, you do this or else you go back.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I think that was really, really important for him, and a really important thing to make his character really grow.
Well, Arthur clearly saw it too, because it wasn't the patrons that voted for Arthur to spill those beans to Noel. That was all Arthur. He clearly sensed that John needed this.
100%. And I think, I established that a little bit in the beginning of 38 or 39 and a little bit at the end of 38, where I think Arthur is, during his sort of confession, he's kind of like, I never, you know, I haven't given you a chance to do this. And it was always something I had in my document of ideas. And it's really funny to go through my document of weird thoughts that, like, to see where they ended up, you know, like, for example, I would say, I don't know, two episodes, like maybe the first episode the butcher is in. The first episode the butcher is in that he talks about hearing music. I wrote down in my document, butcher's head explodes. I can't hear the music. I was like, that's how he'll die. Like, that's the best way to die. Because I think that's so cool. I was like, that's so fucking, which to me was like, well, how do I get that in? And now I want to be clear. A lot of the ideas I write down, if the choices don't make it happen, they just get scratched out. But of the ideas that haven't been scratched out, you know, that was one that ended up kind of getting its path. You know, I would say half of the ideas, I was like, oh, you know, like, no, we'll die this way. It's like, it doesn't work anymore because they chose this or whatever, cross it out.
Your document's the multiverse in some other malevolent that Noel death.
I mean, and I think that's a really cool and interesting thing that Kane talks about too, is like all of these versions that are slightly different. Obviously it's meta because it's talking about the patrons. And I think I was really, really excited to make that scene because that's the first choice. And I think most listeners understand that, but that scene in Intermezzo where Arthur and Parker and John and Kane are in the closet, that's the first choice of the entire series. Do you fire? Do you shoot Eddie? And then, you know, dark third. Like, he's like, I love this version of you.
So good. Oh, I hope the fans run with that.
Oh, they'll listen. I fully expect people to be changing their names on the Discord to Dark Arthur or Dark Third. Joe called it immediately after listening to it. She's like, so many people are gonna be changing their name to that. Obviously, you know, all those choices matter. So yeah, that document of like things crossed out, you know, yeah, there are things that in the Intermezzo episode that were choices that got crossed out, you know, and little satisfying things too, like that hole in the wall breathing scene, which I'm really curious to how many people are going to understand it right away, how many people are vaguely, and how many people it immediately clicks for. Because that was so long ago.
It was so long ago. And the episode is already so dense with.
It's so dense. Yeah. But that was a really cool thing I was excited about. And I knew, again, an idea. You know, I was like, listen, when Kane is flashing through worlds, they'll go back to that and they'll hear the breathing and it'll be Arthur on the other side of the wall. And I was like, I thought that was such a cool. The shame is the things I didn't get to put in the Kane Intermezzo episode because for timing and just work. I was like, well, it's not really worth it. And, you know, as a writer, you know this. Half of it is what you just don't include because writing too much becomes... I knew I wanted like four flashes. That was important. And any more would be superfluous. Any less, it would be too little to demonstrate the power. But, you know, I had a few ideas. I fully had the idea to show the conversation between the butcher and Noel and Arthur in the thing to be like, look, you know, da, da, da. But again, I was like, well, this is just, it detracts. Butcher's dead now. Let's not hear his voice. More fun that way, you know?
Well, and leaving it up to the listener just means there's more opportunity to fill in your own
fan stuff too, right? Like the amount of AO3s that get to play with alternate realities, which, and this is kind of an allusion to, you know, people have talked about the Farrowverse and stuff like that too. And, you know, I've tweeted once, like, you're not the first to come up with this idea, not to say that the amount of work put into it, obviously, but in terms of like me being like, oh, cool. Well, there'll be realities with this, realities with this. Like, yeah, there's I established episode one that there is multiple, you know, realities. You kidding me? Like, you don't think I've considered the idea of a Farrowverse? It'd be so cool.
Yeah. Farrow with a shotgun. Hell yeah.
Yes.
You mentioned very, very briefly about some of your writing process, which is until you actually sit down and write the episode, you're not 100% sure like what the feelings are or what it's going to be. I remember you mentioning in season 4 writing Marie's final scene and not knowing that that was going to happen at all until you sat down. Can you talk about that and other times that happened during this season?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, so typically my like writing process will be like the idea stage. You know, I'll always be throwing in small little things to how I want it to, you know, be. And for example, funnily enough, the book that you gave me, I was using for Intermezzo, and I wrote, so wait, actually here's a flash that didn't happen. Arthur Coma, Kane, Pillow Kill. I had this idea that Kane brings them to the part where Arthur's in a coma and like walks up and like smothers them with a pillow to be like, see, you die in this one. And I thought that'd be really funny. I also took the baby scene with Arthur very dark in one version. And I actually talked to Joe about it. I was like, is that? And we both kind of decided, you know what? I think it's just better to leave it as is. But there was definitely a version where, you know, Kane was like, hey, you know, I mean, there's a baby mm-hmm. here and I'll mm-hmm. just kill it. So, but like here I wrote, let me tell you a story. Story reveals that Henry lived in other worlds. Arthur birth. Kids are great. I have a daughter. She'd love you. Blackstone is what I want. Others have failed. I'll give you a deal. Sam is already. I'll make him forget. I want you two to succeed. Like little kind of notes like that. So especially a big episode like Intermezzo will start like that with like a distillation of the big bullet points. And then when I think Intermezzo, I was really daunted by because so much has been leading to it. And I wanted to be so succinct with the words and the interpretation that I was kind of overwriting the bullet point part. And I was kind of getting nowhere. And then the minute I started writing it in Kane's voice, I was like, oh, this is so much easier because I know Kane, this is how he'd tell it. You know, it adds more like pauses and humor and jokes and whatever. Just it started flying through. And that's when all the little subtleties started to come out. So once I write in the dialogue, and the same with Marie, you know, once I was writing her dialogue and hearing her voice in my head, I realized that there was so much more to her in speaking. You know, like as she's talking, she wouldn't just say, anyway, Arthur, it's nice to see you. You know, she's like, oh, no, this is like a person. And when I write, I'm seeing it play out in my head. I'm always a visual writer, which is ironic because it's audio. But I'm always a visual writer. And I saw her sitting in this like flower patterned high back chair. And I saw the sun leaking through. And I saw her looking towards it. And I was like, that is perfect. That makes sense. And once you're in that voice, it's easier to envision the scene. And then I think I get another creative input when I do the sound effects and editing. So really, I do a part of the writing in editing in a way too. And to take Intermezzo, for example, because it's the freshest in my mind, in the final scene when Kane is telling Arthur to play piano, I originally just had Arthur play the song for Rose Goodbye. And then as I was editing it, I was like, this doesn't make sense. Arthur would stop and Kane would like forcibly be like, keep going, because there's just too many, you know, like dramatic moments in Kane's speech that Arthur would be distracted by. Mm-hmm. So I ran back to the booth, added a few like, keep going, added artificial pauses. And that's how that happens. And I mean, sometimes it's not big moments either. It's jokes like the closet scene with Kane and Dead Parker, the clacking of the teeth. That's
so good.
Entirely, I didn't write that. I was just like, I envisioned Kane just being like, okay, Arthur, blah, blah, blah. But then I was like, oh no, he's got to fucking grab this dude's mouth and like jank it around and you hear the squishing. And that elevated it immensely, you know? So that was storytelling I got to do in sound effects. And honestly, this is one of the cool things about getting to do all parts of the show is that I'm directing every aspect of it. You know, I would be so annoying working with actors or a sound effects person because I'd be like, oh, try this. It's so nice to get to do it myself because as I'm listening back or as I'm remixing, I'm like, oh no, this needs a little bit more of that. And it's really, mm-hmm. really nice to get to do that. So writing in the voice gives me all of those kind of moments, and writing doesn't stop, I think, until I give it to Joe to listen to. And then even then she'll be like, oh, you know, add a pause here or something like that.
I have to also compliment your Kane voice, hearing him in Intermezzo, especially after so long. It's like Mark Hamill is the Joker level good.
Oh, wow. Thank you. Yeah, Kane's easy to slip in because it's just me with more like just energy, honestly. The toughest thing is just when to record, because I'm like, man, that it takes a lot of like yelling and laughing and like, you know, like all that kind of maniacal, heated stuff. And But yeah, there's a few, it's funny because there are a few moments in Kane's speeches in 40 and Intermezzo that, again, weren't written, but I just really liked. Like the, there's a part where he's talking about Arthur and he's like, you just can't really do that.
Yes!
And he kind of like laughs to himself. It's very weird, but I really like that. That was just like a recording booth thing.
And we got not, so much like, more of his personality this time, I feel like.
Yeah. Well, and it's funny too, because I tried to walk the line because I don't want him to be too cartoonish. Like I do want him to feel like you could listen to part 19 and part Intermezzo and feel like it is the same character. And I, you know, I do have the tendency sometimes to, you know, I mean, John sounds so different from one to now. That is purposeful because I wanted that. But I do want, and I do think, especially in Intermezzo, there are moments where Kane is more like calm and like kind of like mm-hmm. he was in 20, which is purposeful. But it's really nice to kind of know what a character sounds like in your head. Just an unhinged version of you, I suppose, with a lot of energy is Kane.
You wrote a lot of new voices this season, introduced a lot of new characters. Which one was the easiest to slip into? And which gave you some struggles?
No, easiest. New York is like more or less like pre, you know, it doesn't really matter if it's like New York or Boston. Like, it doesn't really matter. Like, Noel could be putting it on fake, you know what I mean? Marie, once I found her voice, was really easy to do. Well, I should say this. Sometimes I'd have to like retake it because the speeding up sounded a little too artificial. And like, I would say there's like one or two words in season four that I kind of wish I retook. Not a big deal. I would say in increasing difficulty, Oscar was like kind of up there. Butcher is like in the middle. There were sometimes like Prelude Butcher is like really Irish. 40 Butcher is a little less, but I'm not too worried about that. Like, you know, I think he was putting it on really, frankly, at the beginning. And Oscar was more difficult just because certain words sound really weird to my ear trying to put on a Scottish accent. I would say top, though, was the Grand Vizier, the Werner Herzog.
Werner Herzog.
Really fucking tough. Once I got into it, I could do it. I'd have to like talk like him for a little bit to try to, you know, but like it also kind of like sometimes slid into Jamaican weirdly. Like, I guess because there's like an enunciation thing. I don't really know. But Grand Vizier, I think, was by far the toughest. Oh, you know what? Easiest, Larson. I should have put him first. Oh. Larson is fucking simple. My God.
In every way.
Oh, he's my favorite character in the show, I think. He's such a fucking shitbag. I cannot get over him. In episode 40, I was so happy with how much of a fucking dick. I mean, when he shoots Noel, it's...
Oh my God.
I can picture... And you know what? Like, I grew up on 90s movies and like the... I feel like the 90s were the height of like the petulant villain where like he like shoots and runs away. Like, without a doubt, one of my favorite movies of all time is Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves. And Alan Rickman is like the most fucking weeny, you know, like he's such a, and like the part where Robin Hood bursts in the room at the end and he like grabs Maid Marian, like kisses her. Just, it's like such a fucking scuzzy thing.
So
but,
slimy.
But he's also, but his portrayal is also so pathetic. Like, it's meant to be, you know, which I love that villain. And you don't see enough of those types of villains. They're either like way too bad. Like, listen, this is like really super serious. Like, this guy's tough. Or they're like not really intimidating. Hmm. And I love the like the little middle ground of like a really pathetic, weeny little character who's like also violent and a piece of shit and intimidating when he wants to be, but like still always under the guise of this like little dweeb. And I love him so much.
We love to hate him. It's a lot of fun. He's a great villain.
I do think so, I must say. I'm really proud because I think season four really exemplified or really solidified him in my mind as like a proper villain because of just the
because he's such a piece of shit. Yeah.
Such a piece of fucking shit. Oh,
yeah.
I love it.
And his,
he's like crawling
his end,
on the ground. Oh.
Oh, yeah. And you could just like feel the smirk. Like, why are you smirking? Yeah. Like, fucking stop it. I'm so glad that he got a fate worse than death. I'm so glad.
He did. Yeah. His eyes fucking blew out of his head. He gets kicked to the dream. My favorite, though, is like, I think I think all of his path led to his no. And I think I said in the Discord, but there's a line where Kane is like, don't you fucking get it? And he's like, no, I don't. Like, no, like, explain it for me, please, daddy. And Kane's like, no, you fucking worthless piece of shit, and kicks him out of there. He's like, you don't get it. Like, name, we choose our names. That's the whole theme, bro. Like, you don't, Narlathotep is nothing to me. I'm Kane, idiot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, it's so good, especially because Larson does this reveal that a certain subset of the fandom has been looking forward to for so long, but he does it in such a like simp, yeah, you know,
yeah, yeah,
like simp. You're That's simping it. For the great old ones, bro. Like,
well, this and is why Arthur despises cultists.
Exactly, exactly. And then Kane just shuts him down. So who fucking cares? That's my second favorite line of the
well, and the that finale. That is also one that I have had since, oh my god, I can't remember. That one is probably a season two idea that I wrote down when I was just like, because people were online and they were being like, oh, I came to Narlathotep and blah, blah, blah. And I remember being like, oh my God, who fucking cares? Like, it's not about that. And then I was like, oh, that's what he'll say. And I jotted it down immediately. And that was like my big, like, oh my God, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter who he is. He doesn't, he would have said if it mattered. Like, anyway, yeah. It's funny.
Speak on that a little more, because you use some references to, you know, the greater Cthulhu mythos stuff. You take names from books, but like the Grand Vizier came from a book, but you changed around the powers a little bit and you really make it your own. And you famously said you have never and will never read Lovecraft because he's a piece of shit.
Yeah.
So speak on using those influences for your own, and then also, I mean, knowing that the fandom is going to go buck wild with their theories the moment you introduce any of that stuff.
Well, I'll say this then and keep it brief. I mean, yeah, the Grand Vizier mask, I think I took verbatim, and I think for the most part a lot of the objects I guess I take are kind of canonical, if you want to put it that way. Like the crystallizer of dreams is a real thing. The lantern was kind of a real thing. I think I might have skewed what it does, but just because I think that adds some cool, you know, connections to things that you might have known. Yeah, like if you played Call of Cthulhu, you're like, oh, I know that. That's kind of fun. I think. I know I've jazzed a bunch of them up and changed my own.
The glass of laying, I think, is one.
Yes. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. But in terms of like, and I think Intermezzo is a really nice kind of answer to that. And what I'm basically trying to say, or what Kane outright says, is like, the way you think you know these gods, the way you think you know any of this in this world is no longer the case. Shub-Niggurath, this like great old one, is just fucking gone, like dead, doesn't even exist in all these other worlds. And you only know about it because she was deleted from this world. Me, what you think me? No, I'm none of that anymore. I'm whatever the fuck I want to be. And when Kane's ultimate goals come across, it's going to be even more revelatory, I suppose. Like, it's going to be very interesting to see like what he actually wants, because I know people have theories and they're wrong. but the idea that the things you know in this world are no longer the case is really my theme. And I struggled with a way to articulate that. I think the piano analogy ended up working miraculously well, I think, in my mind.
I think it worked really well, and especially because it ties into the way that you talked about opening portals, which is also music-based. These
yes.
very deeply musical-based ways yeah. of describing undescribable things.
Exactly. I was really proud of that. And then the fact that he gets to actually play it was just, it's like, okay, this all works out really, really well. Which is the only part of Intermezzo I wrote pre. I wrote that before I started working on the finale. I wrote Kane's explanation of who he is, just so I could kind of work backwards from that point. But I knew this was where we were going to end, which is very different from any other season. Every other season, well, definitely season 1 and 3. Season 2, a little bit more idea. I was like, okay, I know I want to end with the King confrontation. So that's why also it ends on a nice clean 20. But like season 1 ends on randomly 12. And then season fucking 3 ends on like, I don't know,
28.
It's just like random, because those seasons were like a little less, here's where I want to end with it. Mm. But yeah, you know, the gods in this world in Malevolent are very much skewed, altered, different versions. Because if we can extrapolate that Cain is this version of Narlathotep, one where, excuse me, but when he says, you know, I killed them.
When he revealed that, I lost my mind.
Yeah, he says, I killed them, executed by this one.
This guy.
You know, that just, you can then kind of assume, okay, well, what other truths are about the gods? I mean, we already know King in Yellow fractured. We know that the real King in Yellow was yanked from the Dreamlands and thrown into Arthur, which to me is a really fun piece that I think is alluded to. I don't know if I cut it or it ended up in the episode, but the Dreamlands have been a lawless waste since the beginning of season 3, which is kind of cool. There's no King in Yellow there. What does that look like? You know what I mean? Yes. Like, what the fuck is going on there? And, you know, and so much of this is about not giving the whole picture too, right? Like, I love people trying to extrapolate and figure out things like that too. And I, in a large part, don't want to give all the answers. I just want to give enough to make people feel satisfied and, you know, nip a few things in the bud. Who was breathing in that wall in Addison? Okay, cool. Checkmarked. Done. That's closed. What would have happened if we had shot an Eddie? Done. Checkmark. Closed. You know, I want certain things completely wrapped up. Who escaped the pits, you know, and because that's satisfying for them too. But there's still a lot of the mythos that I do want to keep kind of vague so that people can make their own assumptions or guesses, or I get the opportunity to surprise people.
Absolutely. Which you did very consistently in part 40 in Intermezzo.
I'm really proud of that. Yeah. I would agree with that, honestly. I think there's like three big, I did not see this coming. And I think the first is the butcher working for them. Mm-hmm. I think the second is John being projected is probably the biggest one. Mm. And then I think the memory wipe fake out is the big one for Intermezzo, which I was really proud about.
And I didn't say I would close his ears.
Yeah, that was fun. I really liked that.
So good.
Thank you.
You already knew where this season was going to end, which you said is pretty different from your other seasons. As you got closer to the finale, did it get harder to maneuver everything into place?
I think I do enough, like, theorizing and jotting little ideas down to really, at the end of the day, when it came to the finale, it was about assembling them. I would say my biggest failure with the finale was just how long it was, honestly. It's for multiple reasons. Number one, I wanted to end on chapter 200. I think around chapter 187, I was like, I could nail this out in, you know, but that came, ironically, as a result of lengthening the farm episodes, purely because, well, A, my daughter was born around that time, and I was like, okay, well, need to slow down a little bit. But also, I was like, you know, I'm enjoying the scene. I'm enjoying Oscar. I'm enjoying what could happen. I'm enjoying the revelation of that little arc, which is who scratches, which is really fun. But just kind of enjoying myself more. But I think what it did was it made me realize, oh, I want season 4 to end on part 40, and now I need to make it really lengthy. And, you know, an hour and 40 minutes, I recognize, I hope the negativity will be like, oh, God, that's long, but I'm happy about it. I'll just find the time, rather than be like, oof, too long, no thank you, because I do recognize that people's time is precious, but that's why public release splits up into two pieces. So
yeah, I doubt you're going to be seeing a lot of that. Knowing how many people come to this podcast by binging it in as short as I think I've seen somebody just like not take a break at all to a weekend or like a week. People love getting through partially because of the plot and the mystery. The way that you do cliffhangers makes it impossible to stop listening. Mm-hmm. And then the characters, Arthur and John especially, their relationship and wanting to see where it's going, and are they going to continue arguing, are they going to evolve in their relationship, you know.
True.
So well, I don't think you're going to hear a lot of complaints about the finale being long. I think it's going to delight people, in fact.
I hope so. I mean, there definitely will be complaints, but yeah, you're probably right. I probably won't hear much of them. But yeah, I mean, I would say that was my only, quote unquote failure. Because I just run myself ragged, you know, like right. Every week I was making
a lot of work.
23 minute episodes. So it's like an 11, 12 hour workday, more or less in just, you know, I might just be staring at a page sometimes, but, or helping out with the baby and doing other fun things to kind of supplement my time. But for the most part, it was a lot. And I'm officially going to say, for anybody listening to this, and I'll probably make a post, season 5, chapter 1 of season 5, whatever, 201, it's going to be nice and short. Chapter 2, 3, 4, the first few parts are going to be back in like the 30 to 40 minute range. Do Good. Not expect anything big Good. Because I need to reset the pace. It needs to drop right back down.
100%. Yeah, you can't have those big meaty freaking 25 minute chapters.
Well, exactly. I mean, it's never what I intended to do anyway. You know, it was never really meant to be an over hour show. It's always meant to be like a 35 to 45 minute show.
Since you knew where season 5 was going, some might say, not me, might say the votes might not matter so much since they can't totally derail the plans. But you and I know the votes matter. So speak on the votes for a minute. What do the votes represent to you and why do they matter?
Happily. It's so interesting. I think, and actually I would love to talk about this because I think a lot of people misunderstand what like votes mean. When we think of voting, we think like, I mean, if you're American, I suppose. I'm not, by the way, but if you're American, you think, oh, this candidate or this candidate, and that's going to like change the course of your entire 4 year, whatever. You know what I mean? But like when you look at the votes, I would urge people to look at the roots of a tree maybe more than a this or that, meaning that some choices, they're influential. But the reason the butcher came to the end was because of a choice in maybe the train episode or maybe a choice in the Daniel episode. Like, these aren't choices that decide the fate of a character. They're choices that lead to a path that alter the entire direction of where where the show ends up. Now, season 5, whether episode 39... Noel had nothing to do with Arthur, Marie was dead, and Oscar was standing next to Arthur in the rain, still would have said, okay, we're going to go to the Order tomorrow. Like, that always would have been the case. But who would have been helping him in the Order, whether the butcher would have been alive or dead, whether Larson would have been missing a fucking arm or not. Like, there's so many little things that would have changed the entire course of the show that get built upon and built upon and built upon, because I only write for the next chapter. I mean, if I were to sit down now and write out what I think season 5 will be versus what it will be in a year from now, it'll be so different. And again, even at the beginning of this, I talked about what season 4 in my mind was going to be, which was like, I wanted more cop, robber detective type stuff. I wanted more like, I mean, fucking even that hotel. And this, I never intended Arthur to, you know, meet Oscar at all, really. That was a distillation. I never intended for Scratch to be introduced the way that Scratch was going to be. That, I mean, that's a long-winded answer that will come at season 6. But there's elements there that, like, totally were just based on the choices and kind of what happened. And subplots were written in the throes of season 4 because of choices that people made and you know, came back. So do your choices matter in the way that, you know, it will, one choice will dictate the entire outcome of the show? No. If I write something entirely, and I'm talking entirely different based on what you've chosen, I mean, that would just be so jarring.
Chaos.
It would be chaos, and it would be ugly. It would sound ugly, you know? Like if John and Arthur were like, well, you know, should we do this? And then Arthur is like, no, there's no way we can do that. Or, it would just sound really gross. It wouldn't be a good show. But do the choices accumulate and like make a like an arc in the direction of where you're heading? 1,000%. And I could point to almost every single choice in the show. I would say even Bread and Cheese ended up being not only a huge discussion in the, like, you know, the poll community, but is still a like famous decision vote. could you really argue that that was meaningless if it had an impact on the community? Because isn't, at the end of the day, the votes are meant to be a reflection of the community? Like...
Exactly. In the commentary track for part 7, which is a Patreon exclusive, you said, "We're playing a game, the patrons and the storyteller, and I think most people who have bought into the experience understand that this is a game, it's a story, that this is fun." Mm-hmm. So what was the most fun you had playing the game with the patrons in season 4?
Man. I mean, there was a few flips that were really satisfying.
Oh, yeah. The triple
flip. Trying to remember.
There was the one where there were three choices to go to the hospital. And it was two of them were essentially talk to somebody. And then the third was sneak around. That ended up flipping three times.
Yeah, that one was really interesting. I remember that one. That was with the butcher and all that, right? But the flip that I remember being really fun or satisfying was... God, what are the other flips? There was one that I really liked. That one was fine.
Oh, the ring versus knock with Daniel. That one haunts me.
Oh, the ring versus knock. That was really fun. Yeah, that was really interesting. Because I had like kind of a flow chart of like, you know, what would happen. Because I planted the seed earlier, you know, he wrote a letter to knock at the door or whatever. I can't remember which I went with now, but I think you guys chose the wrong one, didn't you?
Oh, we definitely did. Yeah, we chose
You would have known. There's no way. And that's the thing, too. People are like, well, what's the right answer? It's like, well, A, sometimes there's no right answer. Mm-hmm. B, sometimes there's no way to know the right answer.
That's
like,
exactly right. Oh, yeah. And in the Discord, we... have so much, we own our L's. We are like, yeah, maybe we shouldn't have gone upstairs. Maybe Oscar would have lost an arm.
Yeah.
You know?
There's like, only a few people that are like, no, I stand by because it's true for this or whatever. But I've seen, especially in the last one, when Arthur was go willingly.
Oh,
I think that might have been the one that, I think that was the most satisfying one because I got to weigh in and talk about who Larson is. And I think that's the one I had most fun with because I think Larson hasn't gotten screen time in a while, but also I think a lot of people didn't really understand what I was leaving breadcrumbs for in terms of who Larson is, you know, like, and here's a guy who's eating an apple across from Arthur at the table. Like, what kind of person do you think that is? Is this a guy that's asking you a question? Do you go willingly? Like, seriously? Or do you think, after coming from another room where he had a scene played out, that he's trying to reflect a part of your life that he learned about because of the voice in his head? You know what I mean? Like, he's doing it to be a kind of a fuck, you know? Here, and to me, it was really satisfying to kind of just ask questions and be like, what kind of person do you think Larson is? And I think the question I asked was, why do you think Larson is asking this? And a lot of people were like, well, because he needs Arthur to be willing to go through the thing. And I was like, but why, how, where does that come from? Why do you think that? And they're like, well, in part 12, you know, so it was really kind of nice to like, not coach, but like kind of walk people through their own theories.
Yeah.
And I mean, I have said this many times. It's so often, and there's a famous Sir Arthur Conan Doyle quote that's been in my mind because I love playing murder mystery escape games and stuff like that, where it's like, you know, don't let your theories lead to assumptions or rather.
It's you're making the facts suit the theories rather than the theories suit the facts.
Exactly. And I think that happens sometimes knowingly and obviously and sometimes to the benefit because, you know, like I said, there's no right answer. Sometimes you make a fact guess and you jump on it and it ends up being beneficial for the story and for the characters. But that was definitely one where I was like, I don't think everyone's really understanding what kind of person Larson is based on evidence, you know?
Yeah. I loved that because sometimes you do let us just run away with our assumptions and we make just somebody says something that becomes something else. And then that becomes the cornerstone of the vote all of a sudden.
100%.
And sometimes you let us run with that. But for this one, I really liked how first it was, we were going to try to get a crit for not willingly.
Yeah.
And that was what was going on in the first like 24 hours. And then you came in and said, okay,
who said Arthur needs to be alive to use the machine?
Yes.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden we were like, oh no. So then it was tied for most of the weekend. And then you came in again and we had like this great dialogue about Larson as a character, just beyond even the vote, to be able to have a creator and have it be like a trusting, open, respectful space to just talk about a character, almost like a DM, you know, sitting around the table after a session talking about the NPC. And I just love it.
Well, and I think that's a big thing that sets the show apart, that I think, and going to your question, when you talked about people who get the game and people who don't get the game, that's exactly it. That's the game to me. Like, for me, people might say I'm a creator, and yeah, I am, but I like the way you phrase it almost, where like there are times when I almost want to be more of a DM and be like, yeah, but what do you think this guy's doing? Because that's the fucking fun. Like, this is all just a big game and it's a big show and it's just about, you know, a path of these characters, and there's no good or bad. There's no right or wrong. And to me, when you understand, and I think another question I was asking too is like, okay, so you want to go willingly. How do you think Noel would react? How do you think John would react? What the people around you right now, what are they going to say? You know, and people will be like, well, Noel might be okay with it. Like, what do you though? Look at this guy who's like, spit in the eye of yellow for 10 fucking years. You think he's gonna be like, yeah, Arthur, go willingly, you know, like like, understand where you're at. And to a degree, as a GM, I'm like that too, where it's like, you know, I've played a bunch of convention games, and convention games are always the best for bringing new people into the game. And one of the staples of Call of Cthulhu is treat the game real. Like, treat it like, you know, like, you don't have 100 hit points like in D&D. You have like 6.
Yeah.
And if you pull a gun out in Call of Cthulhu at a cop, you'll get shot. Or if you, you know, fight a monster, you get shot. And there's a moment of like, you know, treat the scenario that you're in real. And I think more than anything, not to say one way or the other about the willingly, but like, imagining you're standing in Arthur's shoes and you are that character. You know, I think the people who have the most success in enjoying the story are the ones who take the votes as a story rather than as a, well, I wouldn't do that, or, you know what I mean? And I think Danny's mom is the one who does it.
Yep. Danny's mom is the one who gets it right every time. Okay. We should quickly go through. Now, we can't talk about everything that happened in season 4. I'm going to try to get through just a couple of points of the crazy shit that went down in season 4, because as I was going through it, I was like, oh man, this has been a long season.
Yeah.
A lot of things have happened. Okay, the train and loosening the caboose. That, we start with that.
I remember thinking that. I was like, man, I want to start season 4 off with like a real big espionage vibe, which I tried to echo in the finale a little bit too. Like, I wanted like a Mission Impossible almost type like vibe, not with the like the gymnastics of it, but like, yeah, running across the top of the train and, you know, shit. Yes. Like that. So,
and the bait and switches with the butcher and the spy craft and the unreliable narration.
Mm-hmm. I mean, so. Yeah, the train, obviously, like, I wanted to get this vibe set, and it all also changed a big part of New York, because the final choice of that was like jump off the train, which I had a whole kind of mapped out idea of like, cool, like Arthur's kind of back in the wild a little bit, and there's like a bit of a cat and mouse in the woods. And, you know, that's a big reason why the butcher doesn't show up until Daniel's house, because of that choice. So again, talking about choices, like there's a big one that changed a lot of the show.
And then everything with Scratch. I mean, we haven't even talked about Scratch. Just,
yeah,
the nightmare.
Scratch is very interesting. Really proud about how that came out. I knew I wanted in fact, Scratch sort of came up because the butcher was in the back burner because of that choice again. And like, I wanted a little bit more of an antagonist. But Scratch, as we know from the episode where Scratch was quote unquote banished, there's kind of something more there, and I don't want to give too much away, but I will say that Scratch is not over
very much. I mean, we have the woman behind him.
Yeah, the woman who's been mentioned, seen, and now interacted with.
Yes.
Do you know who that is? Did you figure it out? Did they figure it out? Yeah.
Yeah.
We know who Lilith is, right?
Yeah.
And I kind of hint at it in Intermezzo as well, which is really interesting.
Yes, I noticed that. There are some people on the Discord that are going to be extremely happy with that line.
I mean, I think it's no secret to say that that is also seed planting for a bit of a bigger part. I think that's a season 5 thing too, which will be really fun. Now there's another seed I planted in Intermezzo too, which I'm really interested. I don't think people are going to pick it up until the beginning of season 5.
Interesting.
Actually, I won't say it, but okay, you have to cut this. But I'm going to say there's going to be a cool thing about. So, and I've teased this in the Discord, I don't know, like a month ago, where I was like,
That's going to be awesome. That's okay.
But But we cut that.
Yeah, cut that. Yeah. The Kane versus Anna question for the Vanguard seemed like it would have gone horribly, horribly wrong if we had voted for Kane.
Very, very different. Yeah. And, you know, it's funny because people were like, well, the Vanguard hasn't talked. It's been like 2 days. You know, it's not been that long. So
barely 48 hours.
For real.
And then the whole nightmare episode. I mean, we could talk about that for fully 3 hours.
That was really fun. I would say the nightmare, probably since the first episode of the Dreamlands, the nightmare felt the most freeing to write. And it came the easiest, and it came the quickest, and it was hands down the most fun. Because when you write a show this long, it's all cumulative. It's all about what's come before. You know, Arthur reaches into a bag, what's been in there before, what's in his bag. The nightmare gave me permission to just go wild. And I'm really excited for season 5 because I get to do that again. I mean, I'll tell you, the amount of times I researched New York shit, you know, like a lot of people, and this is a fun little inside, a lot of people talked about the Egyptology references when they went to the Freemasons. That's all in the Freemasons building. I watched videos of tours of the Freemasons buildings.
I knew
they're
it.
They're all connected. So a lot of people were like, oh, this is so interesting. And I was like, no. In fact, that wall of photos that he finds Aldrich Ward on, that's a wall of photos in the New York offices. To a degree, too, the floor that they go to is the floor of the executive offices of the Freemasons building in New York, which you can tour. So obviously I had to backdate it and I tried to find photos and stuff like that. But one of the biggest taxing things about New York in general is you can map the route that Arthur takes around New York. You can see he walks from Grand Central to the Tudor Tower Hotel. He takes a taxi up to Marie's place, takes a taxi to Daniel's place. The whole Daniel Butcher like chase scene, I mapped out basically where they are. The Lenox Hospital is like within running distance from that. You know what I mean? It's all very interesting. And the road that the farm is on, Boulder Road, I would love the listeners to Google Boulder Road, New York, because I think a lot of people, I didn't see one person reference that. I don't think anyone caught that.
Oh, interesting. Very interesting. When I was listening to that description, I knew you had done what I have done, which is go down a research hole. And it's somewhat good, but then it's also so exhausting.
It's the worst.
Taxing.
Because you know what it is? It feels like, and I've said this to Joe many times this season, I will spend 2-3 hours researching or whatever, and I'll come to her and be like, I've done nothing this morning.
Yep.
And she's like, well, you've been doing this. And I'm like, but you don't understand. When you're working without producing something, it feels like you've wasted time. Mm-hmm. I know it's not true, but God, the amount of time I've felt like I've wasted, which...
And then for like a throwaway line too.
For like a throwaway line. Oh my God. And I will say season 5 is not going to have that. And I'm excited to talk about season 5 a little bit, but I want to be clear at this point for those who now know where season 5 takes place. This is not going to be the medieval England that you scholars know about. This is got a very specific vibe to it that this is not, you know, there's no...
It's Harlan Guthrie's
This
medieval.
Is a Leary equivalent. This is going to be... This is... Yeah. And I'm excited to talk about that in a second.
I think it's time to talk about season 5.
Yeah.
Can you tease a little bit of it for us?
Yeah. I want to tease the vibes. I want to tease the intentions. I want to tease the feelings.
The mood.
Yes. Season 5 is going to be so much more like season 2 in the vibes of solitary, in the vibes of fantastical. If you've seen movies like The Last Unicorn or like, you know, like an era of fantastical medieval England where it's very dark, you know, flame lit, very grotesque, but very monster infused. And I have this personal, very fun, not real, but this fun kind of belief or idea that all of these dragons and goblins and trolls, you know, existed at one point many, many, many hundreds of years ago. And because there's no, you know, video cameras or even really solid written record from, you know, 700 years ago, that these legends just kind of faded away because all of these creatures either died off or did whatever. But imagining a time where these things are more potent, more real, and more exciting and manipulative and dangerous is the realm that we're playing with. You know, if I were to envision season 5, it would be a dark green, mossy, rain-covered summer night with growling in the distance and rumbling underfoot, and the darkness of the Dark Ages is prevalent. And even though it's slightly after the Dark Ages. But I want people to enjoy the ride of season 5. I've talked many times about losing people because I think season 2, I was fearful of losing people, but it was clear that the setting was fantasy in terms of what's been written. I think season 5 could lose a lot of people because the way I'm going to be delving into season 5 medieval era is going to be more fantastical than I think a lot of people might enjoy. You know, I'm not talking about dragons or anything like that, but I just think Army of Darkness, like if you've seen Army of Darkness, that's the tone and the vibe I'm going for, where it's like, yeah, you know, these castles and keeps and, you know, sword fighting, but also like skeletons and fucking demons and,
yes,
you know, pit creatures and that kind of thing. So, you know, if you're into enjoying a show and having a good fucking time, I think season 5 is going to go hog wild in that shit. Really enjoyed the more grounded, you know, plotting out New York map route. That's not going to be season 5's vibe as much. So I think that's where I could lose people. But in my mind,
that sounds fun as hell.
Well, so, and I've said this to you and I've said this to multiple people, like I've envisioned, this has always been the path for season 5. And people who have seen the Call of Cthulhu games know that this has been the path. You know, even Liz has been like, well, this is where it's going to go. Because said it, you know, if you watch the games, it's not a secret. It's always been the plan to kind of head there. This is where the Blackstone is. This is what Cain wants. But I think the way that that world is going to come across is going to be really fucking fun and scary. A lot of horror too. Like a lot more horror in this season, I think.
Yes.
Well, because horror in my mind is a large part isolation. You know, it's like being alone, and it's so tough to have that horror in New York. And again, I succeeded at the vibes I wanted to do for season 4. I have no regrets. I am so proud of season 4 more than any other season. And I think I'll be more proud of season 5 than I am of any other season, because I want to play with different stuff now. I want to play with, you know, and to a degree, like, Divisor came out during season 4 because I needed more horror in my stream. And yeah, I definitely foresee a lot of blood in season 5.
Excellent, excellent. I'm looking forward to Arthur saying, good, bad, I'm the guy with the gun.
Exactly. Well, it's funny too, because I was like, man, there's so many characters in season 4, and there's going to be less in season 5 for many reasons, but one of them also being it's like, there's only that many versions of English characters I can play.
Yeah, but it's Harlan Guthrie's England, so maybe they all have different accents. Who knows?
That's true.
Last question related to season 5. What's the biggest question Arthur is going to face next season? And what's the biggest question John is going to face next season?
I think the biggest question Arthur is going to face is what to do with his, like, with John. You know what I mean? Like, here's an entity that he's time and time again come back to okay, like I'll help you. And this latest betrayal is such another, you know, it's like another fucking throw it onto the fire of, oh my God. And I think Arthur is really going to struggle with the idea of like, how do I fix something that's broken to a degree? And I think the biggest question John is going to face is, who am I? What do I really want out of this? And I think this is season five, in my mind, is going to be, especially at the beginning, because I don't want to tease it the whole season, but leaving season four the way we have with John's character, I think season five beginning is going to be a lot of John being like, what do I want? Like, who am I? I need to figure it out now. And if it goes according to how I'm hoping, season five will be a solidification of John's character before, you know, everything blows up in season six.
I look forward to it. When does season five start for patrons?
Season five, chapter 201, will start February 21st. No stopping, no breaks.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Chugging along.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. To me, it'll be one of those things that, and you kind of said it, you know, people binge it anyway. Like, I'm happy to keep it going. I love the commitment and the pressure, and I thrive on it at times. And realistically, in, you know, 5 years when people re-listen to the show, there won't be any waiting anyway. So what's the difference? You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Harlan, everyone listening is already a fan of Malevolent, but what other projects would you like to shout out?
Oh, definitely check out Divisor. If you haven't heard that already, that's going to be one of the things I'm most proud of the last year. It's a 7-part horror sci-fi little series about the horrors of AI. I really like it. It's about the length of a movie, so you can enjoy it in one long sitting. Also, Dice Shame. I also produce, act in, and edit a actual play RPG show with my wife and our friends called Dice Shame. And I'm extremely proud of it. It's a lot of fun. I play a very different character than Arthur or John or any of the characters you see on Malevolent. And it has well over 200 episodes at this point. And it is a great story to get attached to. If you just love, you know, following zany characters along on their journey, for characters who are tasked with basically saving the world from the uprising of giants who do exist in the world. And these four characters are more or less given this quest from God. And along the way, they, you know, defeat giants and make friends, and some of them even pass away. So definitely check that out. DiceShamePodcast.com, you can check it out. Like I said, I edit and do sound effects on it every week. So it's my other big show. And then, of course, anything new that comes out would be a Patreon exclusive first. So if you're not already a patron, consider joining that.
As for myself, you can find me on Substack, Twitter, and Instagram as Mythoscopes. That's Mythoscopes, like the old aromascope. I've got a book coming out in June called Strangers on the Shore. It's a queer found family spy thriller set in 1963. And if you'd like to know more, you can read the first chapter on my Substack.
It's amazing. Give it a read now. I highly recommend it.
Well, thank you so much, Harlan.
Thank you so much. Are you kidding?
And I'll see you on the Discord.
Yeah, I'll see you on Discord. Thanks, everyone, for listening. Have a great one.
Oh, that's stupid. Never mind. I'm going to cut that.
Fourth year running, I think?
I think so.
Fourth year running? Yeah.
Hold on one second. My cat is losing her mind.
Okay.
Speaking of children who don't have...
For real. I mean, you can cut this, but so this, you can cut this from the show, but he says, hint, hint, but cut that.
Yep.
Here, I'll clap.
Give it a mouth so yeah. We can talk. And I was like, what does that mean?
Definitely some of the things he says echo my feelings at times. Not the mean stuff. Probably.
No, never the mean stuff.
Never the mean stuff.
No.
Definitely like... A voice for how he feels about Larson, like as Larson, as me, being like, you fucking worm, you fucking nothing. Hold on one second.
Oh, hi, Marie.
Okay.
She's just walking by fussing.
Aw.
Nap time.
I have to find the question that I have.
Sure.
Arthur.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Listen to this Acast show ad-free on Amazon Music with your Prime membership, or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.